House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development will come to order. I have a busy agenda today. I appreciate everyone being here and participating. We'll start with opening a public hearing on House Bill. Before I do that, let me tell you something about the sequence here so people have common understanding. We're going to open a public hearing briefly on House Bill 3153 to accommodate Representative Clem's schedule. We'll then close that hearing temporarily in order to proceed with the rest of our agenda, and then we'll come back to 3153, as I know a number of people have journeyed some distance to participate in our hearing. So I want to make sure you understand that sequence. I don't think we're skipping people, but we try to accommodate the other legislators' busy schedules. So with that, open a public hearing on House Bill 3153. Barbara, if you could give us a summary, and Representative Clem, if you'd like to come forward, we're happy to have you.
HB 3153 prohibits the establishment of a utility facility in an area zoned for farm use, forest use, or mixed farm and forest use if the majority of utility service provided by the utility facility will be used within an urban growth boundary.
Thank you. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, state representative from here in Salem, also chair of the House Ag, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities Committee. I appear in front of you to talk to you about House Bill 3153. My primary interest is that in introducing this bill, and I'm certainly open to conversations about changes committee members would feel that need to be made, but the goal for me is that when and if utilities need to cross exclusive farm use and high-value forest use, which are in and of themselves important industries, that the landowners get a decent deal. And so that's the fundamental premise, that farmers need to be compensated, farmers need to be have some consideration to where on their property these lines or these towers or these pipelines, where they would go. So this bill speaks to first trying to get them out in the right of way of the road. If you can't do that, get them on the edge of the property. If you can't do that, then some mitigation, some payments for the crop damage, some requirements around rates paid, leases, to give some tools back to the landowner. And as you can see from the folks here, it's a really big deal. It's really important. And farmland inherently has its own value. And when something else disrupts it, then they need to be paid for it. And they need to be treated in a fair manner. And I don't know that people aren't being treated in a fair manner in any given situation, so I'm not here to indict any particular project or outcome of a project, but I do believe in this principle that farm and forest lands are primarily to be used for timber production and food production, and if it is going to be used for some other purpose, then treat the landowners fairly in the process.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Clem? Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm listening to this, and I haven't really heard a lot about this particular conversation, so I guess what you're telling me is that farmers aren't justly compensated for the easements that go through their lands for utility purposes?
I think you'll hear from a lot of farmers that will tell you specific stories, but the reason I did the bill was at the request of a bunch of farmers who either have not been in the past or are worried they will not be in the future, that the depths of the of various, if we're talking LNG, I've talked to a lot of Washington County farmers about what their concerns would be in how they're treated, because so many things have eminent domain authority or have FERC preemption that the state is interested, I think, in having some tools to make sure they're treated fairly in light of those sort of federal standards around things or eminent domain type authority. We still can make sure they're treated fairly in that process.
Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, perhaps you could mention the broad scope of people that are concerned about this issue, because I think I know a bunch of my folks are here today, but they're here for transmission lines, and I think you mentioned other types of transmission that's of concern, and possibly you could share with us the scope that this bill of issues this bill was originally supposed to apply to.
Well, I've had a variety of people come in and seeing the bill and saying, wow, we're dealing with towers. And then I had windmill people concerned that, you know, are we a problem? We thought we were working pretty well with farmers. So, you know, from my perspective, the ones I've heard about are power lines, LNG lines, towers. You know, we've talked about in flight paths of where aerial operators are trying to help get the farmers' spray down. And those things all have to be thought about. You know, we have an orchard in Hood River, and we don't have on our property any other utility lines, but not far over there are some giant ones. And I don't know the relationship there, what income stream, if any, that farmer got or is getting. I don't know if they're unhappy or happy, but I certainly have heard on LNG, power lines through eastern Oregon. You know, it's a very common refrain that if it's going to come through our property, let's have something in state law that says before you go on EFU, we're just going to be subject to whatever we think we can get, you know, and hope that we are treated well in the process. And I mean, there's, you know, like the language in here that talks about it may not even be located in EFU if it's going to be used in an urban growth boundary. I have a feeling that's probably not even legal under federal law. But there are elements of this that certainly are legal and within the state's rights to do. And I'm hoping that, you know, you can find your way to listening to the public, seeing if there's something that can be done. Because I think you will hear some stories of people who either have been or believe they are going to be not treated well in the process.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you for being here. I appreciate you bringing the bill. With that, as I mentioned, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3153 temporarily. We will return to it after we proceed through the rest of our agenda. So close that and open a public hearing on House Bill 3038. Barbara, if you could give us a quick summary, please.
HB 3038 requires the Public Utility Commission to undertake a study of electricity needs in Oregon in order to identify opportunities for the development of electricity from renewable energy sources, requires the Commission to report the results to the 76th Legislative Assembly, repeals the Act January 2, 2012.
Thank you. We have a number of people who are interested in testifying on this bill, and we'd like to accommodate that, but we also have a busy schedule, as you can see. So I'm going to ask folks to keep their comments to 3 minutes, and I will do my best to enforce that. Let's start with Teddy Kaiser, Bianca Bass, I think that's an S, and Judy Barnes, please. I'll start the clock when you start talking.
Chairman Reed and members of the committee, I want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to speak on House Bill 3038. My name is Teddy Kaiser, and I'm from Senator Joanne Berger's office. And just a brief overview, there are three bills on this area. There's House Bill 2121, which is the governor's bill, House Bill 3038, which is put together by a group of interested citizen advocates, and House Bill 3039, which is from the solar industry. In our office, believe strongly in these bills because of two very simple things. One is renewable energy payments work. They have proven to work. They're now implemented in 45 nations across the world, and they've demonstrated they work. In fact, Germany, which instituted this first, now has 15% of its energy portfolio through renewable energy. And the second reason is that, just taking back from our positions here in the Capitol, as a citizen, we want to be a part of the solution. I want to put solar panels on my roof. Senator Berger wants to be able to put solar panels on her small business. Yet the current situation does not make that pencil out. It doesn't work out. And what we've come here today to really stress is that whichever bill goes through, that it have language that makes for a very strong residential component. There are many, many advantages to having a strong residential component. It allows people to be empowered to be part of the solution. It reduces transmission lines because you're creating power where you're going to be using it. For national security reasons, if you decentralize the power grid, there's no easy target. There are many, many reasons. In fact, we see that every solar panel on every roof is a billboard to what we see are the energy solutions of the future. And we've been meeting with banks. In order for residential average citizens to be able to put solar panels on, they need to be able to go to a bank and get a loan. And so we've met with bankers and asked them, what is it that they need to be able to provide a loan? And what they need are four guarantees. They need to be guaranteed that the utility will hook them up, that the utility will enter into a purchasing agreement under parameters that will, over the course of a 20-year contract, provide for the cost of the solar panels, the installation, and a reasonable profit that allows you to be able to pay off the loan. And they also need transferability, so that if a homeowner goes into this agreement and then moves, that purchasing agreement, that contract, can then transfer to the new homeowners. And if they have those four guarantees and transferability, then they will now will be able to leverage private dollars to really bring us into bringing solar to homes all across the state.
That actually passes 3 minutes, so that might be a good place to stop.
Chairman Reed and members of the committee, I thank you for the time to be able to speak to.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing today, and my name is Bianca Barth. I'm from Germany, and I work with the World Future Council, which is an organization that addresses challenges to our common future and provides decision makers with effective policy solutions. So I would like to share Germany's experience with this, with the successful deployment of renewable energy and the feed-in tariff model that Mr. Kaiser just talked about. And he said we have 15% of our electricity produced by renewable energy as of March 2009, which is true. And this is true because of that policy that we have implemented. And apart from producing 15% of renewable electricity, it also produced 280,000 jobs over the course of the last 10 years in Germany. It is really about creating jobs and future careers, and people like it. So why do people like it? It's because customers have the right to be paid for their solar electricity generation at a guaranteed fair market price. And the contract pays for a production over 20 years. So in Germany, basically all the farmers and homeowners and churches and, you know, lots of people came together and pushed that. And if you go through the German villages right now, you can see solar panels on every second house, basically. So I really would encourage you, whenever you have some holidays, go to Germany and look at it, because it's really happening over there, and that's what we want to see, a large deployment of renewable energy all over the world. And another thing is that it diminishes the cost of conventional energy sources over time, and that's another important thing to bear in mind. And it creates the investment security, as Mr. Kaiser mentioned, to enable people to take part of it. So maybe I stop here. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have. And there's also slides I've provided for all the committee members
with
German figures, and you can see what's happening over there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome back, Ms. Barnes.
Thank you, Chairman Reed and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is Judy Barnes, and I reside in Southeast Portland, and I represent Oregonians for Renewable Energy Payments, a citizen advocacy group that represents three distinct constituencies. We represent those in the community who would like to become renewable energy producers, such as homeowners, nonprofits like churches and schools, small businesses, small entrepreneurs. We also represent the local financial institutions who would like to lend into this market, but currently don't find it that it pencils out for them to do so. We're talking about local banks, local credit unions, and private investment groups. The third group that we represent is those who are training or retraining for jobs they hope will be available in the renewable energy production portion of the industry. One of the reasons that we introduced HB 3038-1, the amendments that we're testifying in support of today, is because we as citizens have been made aware of what's going on in Germany. We've seen photographs of all the houses with solar panels on them and heard about the jobs that were being created, and we wondered, how can we have that here in Oregon? And through a lucky set of circumstances, we were able to hook up with an attorney here in Oregon who actually had been doing work for the World Future Council to look at the successful countries where the policy had been implemented successfully. This is the feed-in tariff law they have in Germany, to look at what elements of it work best and to pull those elements out to create a template that then they could shop to other countries. And so our bill was drafted based on that template. Our goal, our vision, is to see that all customers of utilities in this state have the opportunity to become renewable energy producers and get paid well for the energy, the electricity that comes off their rooftop panels. We'd also like to see this model used for all renewable energy sources. Basically, it's a model that, through opening up market forces, drives down the price of a renewable so that it becomes more competitive with fossil fuels in the marketplace. And we'd like to see this spread all over Oregon. We realize that that's a lot to bite off in one swallow, so we're perfectly willing to support a pilot that the governor has proposed, provided that the pilot has in it the elements which will allow it to succeed as a pilot, and those elements are in the template. We've added some, requested some additional language, and they include those four guarantees that Mr. Kaiser mentioned. I also would, so that's what we'd like to see, is a pilot that can actually be successful, because it is a real feed-in tariff model, and then once it's proven itself as a pilot, that we could come back to the committee and consider expanding it into those other realms that I spoke about. I will just mention one thing in closing. The current system of incentives seem to create obstacles for the groups we represent who want to become renewable energy producers. We believe this creates an additional tool, another financing mechanism, and by using a ratepayer surcharge, which is the fund that it pays for the energy on the roof, what we think we're doing is using that money very effectively to leverage private money into the market. And as long as the statute contains the guarantees that give the financial lenders sufficient guarantees that they will lend, then there's a means for financing the upfront costs, which doesn't depend on tax credits.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thanks. Any quick questions for this panel? Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thank you for the dogged determinism that you've shown in really advancing this issue. And Ms. Barth, it's a real pleasure to have you here today and to be able to learn from the experience that other countries have had. And I look forward to pushing for a pilot.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. Other questions? Thank you very much. Next on our list, Chris Nelson, Luz Bagnito, I hope I'm saying that correctly, and Jennifer Gleason. As you're getting settled, same rules apply, please. 3 minutes would be great.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, my name is Chris Nelson from Portland, and I'm a part-time solar consultant. I've been working rather frustratingly for many months now to try and develop a solar system for a nonprofit educational organization that has been attempting to use the business energy tax credit pass-through feature. And perhaps you've heard that given the structure of this pass-through system, it really involves a lot of legal tangles and organizing, corralling individuals or entities with a state tax liability. These days, not so easy. And we're to the point where this is costing me and potentially the project so much that I'm not sure it's actually going to come through. It's just been such a frustration and headache. So should solar power development in times of high unemployment be this onerous? In this condition, shouldn't the process actually go the other way? Shouldn't the process be simple and affordable for nonprofit projects in particular? Shouldn't we even already see thousands of schools and homes and small businesses with solar generation in a state with more solar resource than Germany? Well, here's what the German Employment Report stated 2 years ago about their stunningly successful model of renewable energy development. By 2010, the enterprises intend to increase their number of employees by 50% compared to 2004. Well, we've already heard that Germany's created about 280,000 jobs under their model. And the number of jobs in the report, the German renewable energy sector said would increase to over 300,000 by 2020. Well, it's 2009. In other words, they've exceeded their expectations from 2 years ago. Bianca Barth from Germany reported to us that this is spread over the residential sector primarily. Isn't that remarkable? In other words, maybe that's one reason that Solar World has actually come here. Maybe they couldn't find enough workers to employ in their new plant over there. So why has the German model of financing renewables with production incentives actually exceeded expectations? Well, there are some essential elements. I'll just briefly mention those.
And we're coming up on 3 minutes, so if you could wrap up, that'd be great.
They established long-term contracts for utilities to purchase all the power produced. They enabled a reasonable profit margin in the prices set. And they spread participation over ratepayers countrywide, so no one pays more than the price of a latte a month. So if a pilot project is created here, to wrap up, we'd see how banks would work with homeowners and nonprofits and small businesses to smoothly finance community-scale systems. And that's what we need. We haven't seen that evolve with the Betsy program, and this is really our solution to do that. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Representative Reed, members of the committee. My name is Lou Stagnito. I reside in Multnomah County in Portland, and I'm here as a private citizen. Took some time off work today to come here and speak to you for these 3 minutes, so thank you for the opportunity. I'm here simply as an individual. I work in the healthcare industry, and in our industry, we really are required to be successful to make decisions based on data and best practices. And I happen to work in the information technology area, where it's really required for us to look at anything we do in implementing new systems, to look at best practices. And when we look at what hasn't worked in this state around spurring the renewable energy industry and in this country over the last 30 years, we can see some of the same old programs and policies that have been put into place that really don't support people like myself and average consumers who really want to put solar panels or renewable energy systems on their homes and be part of the solution. So in the best practices model, we'd look at Germany and the other European countries that have adopted a feed-in policy and have been tremendously successful in bringing jobs and renewable energy systems to their people and to their country. And I just challenge you and the state legislature to look at the best practice and to implement something and do something that will add to all of our legacy as a country in reducing the global climate threats that we have. This is something that can easily work. I've been involved as a citizen in another organization that was attempting to bring solar energy to this country, and we continue to see over and over hundreds and thousands of people who would like to put solar panels on their homes that cannot afford it based on the tax credits that are available. They sound very generous, but they don't pencil out for an average person trying to support a family like myself who has car payments and who has a 40-hour-a-week job. I'm urging you all to do the right thing, to look at from the consumer perspective that we want the opportunity to contribute to the solution. There are best practices out there. We can adopt those best practices, and we can make a huge difference and lead the way as this state has done in the past. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. I'm sorry I mispronounced your name. The corner of your A kind of curved over, and I thought it was I thought the second letter was a P.
You'll be happy to know you're not the first person in this.
Thank you very much. Ms. Gleason.
Chairman Reed and committee members, my name is Jennifer Gleason. I'm staff attorney for the Environmental Law Alliance Worldwide, which is in Eugene, Oregon. And a few years ago, the World Future Council commissioned myself, a lawyer from Germany, and a lawyer from the United Kingdom, to study feed-in tariff laws from around the world and figure out why some of them are more effective than others, and help them put together information for legislators around the world who wanted to develop strong feed-in tariffs. And I'm thrilled to be here to be able to take those lessons and bring them home to here in Oregon. I, in my job, I help lawyers in other countries develop strong renewable policies, and so excited about doing it here in Oregon. The group of citizens who got together, mostly based in Portland, looking at better ways for Oregon to be developing renewable energy, got in touch with me to help them bring these lessons home. And so I, working very closely with a large group of people, did draft the original language that's 3038-1, and so I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone might have about why we did some things there. But I thought I'd outline briefly some of the major differences between the bills that are in front of you on these issues right now. 3038-1 includes all utilities in Oregon, and I think that that's important. I think that the ability to generate renewables is not just in the investor-owned utility districts, and it would be great to get all of Oregon in. 3038-1 does not make a preference for solar over the other technologies that qualify for our RPS, so it brings in a much bigger variety of technologies. It's not a pilot project. We know these things work, so we're trying to get a strong bill passed now that will help Oregon be a leader in this, in the renewables. The price paid in 3038-1 would cover the generation plus a reasonable return for the generators who are generating. I'm not sure that the language in either of the other bills will be high enough to really get generation happening in Oregon. So I'd encourage you to look at the language in 3038-1 for the parameters for setting the price. 3038-1 has zero impact on the general fund. The ratepayers will pay the increased cost. They have to choose between using the Betsy, Retsy, and ETO funds or opting into this program, which will help us demonstrate what's the best way to generate renewables in Oregon. And it is designed so that non-taxable entities, including schools, nonprofits, municipal buildings, can participate and get paid the same price that taxable entities could be paid. So I encourage you to look at the whole program. If you decide that you're only going to look at a smaller pilot project, I request that you make it a strong enough pilot so that we can show that this is going to work in Oregon.
It must have been that good law school training. You finished up just almost exactly in 3 minutes. Are any questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have made a practice of asking Ms. Gleason, all of the folks that, or as many as I can remember to ask, the additional cost on a percentage basis that this would place upon the ratepayers. And I know pilot project and all that, so I understand it'll be an estimate, but it would be of interest if you could share that with us.
And this one's a little bit harder to estimate, but I will estimate. Because this, as designed right now, 3038-1 does not have a cap on it. And so what we have to do is make a best guess about who would be able to produce, how many people would come in if the prices are set the way we think. And we think that it would be about a 2% increase in ratepayers' prices. And if the cost was the biggest concern, I think that a program could be passed that would add to this, that the there's a cap on the program at a 1% increase for the average ratepayer in Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask a question that you may not know the answer to, but I'd like to take advantage of this in the case that you do. Germany, each of you mentioned the best practices that are available there in terms of renewable energy. That country currently is exceedingly reliant upon energy output from coal-run generation plants. Do you know how long it may be in Germany before high carbon energy generation is replaced by renewable energy?
I don't know. Bianca's the best person in this room.
30%.
Or the majority of renewable energy.
Yeah, we aim to.
Would you like to come forward so that folks can hear that we have a number of people who may be listening on the internet as well?
Well, the target that we have
please
set
have a seat.
For 2020 is 30% of renewable energy, and there are calculations out there that say that we can get to 50% of renewable energy by 20, I think it's 24. 40. But so we still have coal, and we still heavily rely on gas and oil import, especially from Russia. And that's one of the reasons why Germany is pushing so hard for renewable energy, because we definitely have to decrease our dependency on those imports coming from Russia. I mean, I'm not totally sure if this the last figure I gave you is true, but I think we really aim to have to go for the 100% as soon as we can.
Yes.
But it's not possible right now, obviously. But
thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Holby.
thank you. I have a question along these same lines. I suppose that Representative Bentz asked about the cost to the ratepayer, since the utility has to pay the electric the eligible generator for the cost of the installation and all that. I'm wondering though how important it is to have that rate of return of between 5% and 7% for these generators, because that cost the utility has to pay, and that adds to the cost of the ratepayers. And so I'm wondering why there has to be a profit built into this for the people that are putting these generators on the roof.
Chairman Reed and Representative Holby, the reason for that is because we wanted people to take their money out of their CD investments and put it on their rooftop. We want the banks to be assured that people are going to make enough money back from these investments that they'll lend money and get this generation happening. And we put 5% to 7%, which I don't think anyone is clinging to too strongly, as a reasonable rate, because it would take money out of other investments and put it into this. But it is noticeably lower than you would see a utility getting back on their reasonable rate of return if the utility itself is generating.
Follow up, and as you answer, maybe move the microphone a little bit further away from it. It's distorts a little bit less.
And I might take up much more time, but I'm just wondering in Oregon whether or not that incentive is really needed.
Other people here might be able to answer as well, but I would say yes, because right now we've got some incentives out there and we're not seeing the production. I personally am an environmental attorney. I'd love to have solar on my rooftop. EWEB, and I'll give a plug for EWEB, has the best program there is in the state, I believe, and I still can't put solar on my rooftop.
I one last follow-up is I'd love to put solar on my roof too, and I believe I would do it if I could just get the cost of the installing it done. I don't think I'd necessarily need a profit on it. So anyway,
can I respond to that
quickly, please?
Sorry, and I personally have to take a loan out to do that. And so in order to have enough to cover the cost, I need that extra percentage to cover the loan that I would need to take to do it.
And the taxes.
Thank you all very much. We have one more person who signed up, Jolene Goodnight.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Jolene Goodnight. I'm an attorney focusing on environmental law, and I've been studying feed-in tariffs for the past 2 years, working with the Environmental Law Alliance Worldwide with Jennifer Gleason, who just spoke. I would like to express my support for House Bill 3038-1 today. Oregon is fortunate enough to have the opportunity to adopt a feed-in tariff based on the experience of other countries. Based on what is successful elsewhere, a feed-in tariff should include several basic elements to ensure its success. One, it must include an obligation for the utilities to purchase all the renewable electricity produced by the eligible projects under the policy and feed it into the grid. It cannot be left up to the utilities to choose whether or not to purchase this electricity. Two, it must require the utilities to purchase the electricity at predetermined prices. The prices must be set high enough to ensure a return on the project investment plus a reasonable profit. Three, it must require the utilities to purchase this electricity under long-term contracts. This, combined with the predetermined prices, will ensure predictability for those investing in the renewable energy projects. 3038-1 contains these minimum elements. In Section 2, utilities are required to enter into power purchase agreements with qualified projects to purchase all of the renewable electricity produced. Section 3 sets out the contract lengths with nothing shorter than 20 years. Section 3 also sets out the criteria upon which the Department of Energy will base the prices that the generators will be paid. These criteria ensure the prices will be set high enough to actually incentivize investment in renewable energy projects and create predictability for the investors. A well-designed feed-in tariff is a tool that the state can use to meet its RPS goals on time and through a variety of renewable resources. I believe this is a well-designed feed-in tariff policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much.
If I can answer Representative Benson's question.
Please come forward.
Teddy Kaiser from Senator Joanne Berger's office. Just very briefly, you had asked about rate increases, and we'd asked the Oregon Department of Energy to study this. And under the pilot project that's under House Bill 2121 at 25 megawatts, it would take less than 0.2% increase in rates. Or in other words, an average bill of $100 would be about a 17-cent increase for that project. A full-blown project that was 1,000 megawatts would be about a $2 increase. And I have submitted that documents for your more careful study.
Those numbers came from the PUC, did you say?
No, the Oregon Department of Energy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That prompt any further questions from you?
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here and helping us understand 3038. I imagine the topic will return to us before long. So with that, close the public hearing on House Bill 3038 and reopen. Are we ready to go back to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3153? Thanks for your patience on that. And get organized here. We have a number of people who want to be heard. So let's start with James Jennings, Gary Pearson, and Bruce Horn. Oh, and Representative Benz, please. I called three people up, though. You have to help me figure out who needs to wait then. Sorry, Representative Benz.
That's okay.
I didn't mean to hold you up.
Two of you up here. Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Cliff Benz, State Representative District 60, which of course, as you know, is Malheur County, Harney County, part of Grant County, and all of Baker County, about 26,000 square miles, across which lots of transmission lines run and across which many more apparently want to run. Before I present my remarks, I want to mention that I had a conflict earlier in the situation because one of the proposed transmission corridors ran immediately adjacent to my house. And fortunately, it is now off the table. And this is a matter involving the legislation before you, so I'm happy that I don't have that conflict, at least according to Legislative Council. I would like to just point out that 24 people journeyed over from Ontario this morning. I think they left around 3 o'clock. Is that correct? And
glad you're not falling asleep yet. We'll try to keep you awake through this hearing.
We'll try to keep you awake too. 3 o'clock Ontario time would be 2 o'clock our time here. And they plan on turning around and going right back. They were joined in Baker after driving 72 miles by several more people from Baker County and then made that 380-mile trip on over. They appear here today to share with you some of the consequences of transmission that maybe all of us aren't clearly aware of. And their hope, I am sure, is to build upon what Representative Clem said, which is to maybe help develop a better fashion of moving this transmission, this energy across Oregon. You will see before you the Amendment 1, Dash 1, 23153, and the concept underlying that amendment is to impose a height restriction on transmission. The idea being that local planning commissions could decide to look at the ground across which transmission is proposed and then decide if that ground should be preserved for farming use as opposed to transmission. The idea here is not to prevent transmission. The idea is to develop a better means of figuring out where it is to go. I think the 25 people that we have here today is just a small fraction of those who are concerned
I know a petition was signed of some 900 people, and at the meetings I attended, there were 300 or 400 people present. The matter is of great concern, and I'm sure this is just the first of many of these types of situations the legislature will be faced with. So I'm hopeful today that my good constituents can share with you some productive remarks, and that the state of Oregon will be the better for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Would it make sense, and the answer might be no, to walk through the amendment? I'm guessing that some of the folks who are here to testify might be talking about that so that we have an understanding of it as we hear their testimony.
Certainly, Chair Reed. The amendment, really the entire amendment, appears on the first page. And when I say the entire amendment, the current bill would disappear and it would be replaced in its entirety by the 3153-1 amendment.
So it replaces the entire bill.
It does.
In other words, if this were to be adopted, we needn't look at the original 3153,
just
the amendment. Okay.
That is correct. And as you can see, the idea is that this language would be incorporated into our planning statutes, our land use planning statutes, and the idea would be that local planning groups would have the opportunity to identify EFU land upon which transmission powers could be no more than 50 feet in height. And I hope I have that right. If I'm not, my folks will correct
it. It says 50 feet in line 21 of your amendment.
That's correct. Thank you.
Very good.
I'll leave it to
any
my
questions for Representative Benz before he joins us back up here?
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Go ahead. Very late. Go ahead. Yes, well.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, on behalf of all of us from Malheur County, we want to thank you for this opportunity to talk to you for a few minutes. And if we looked a little disheveled, you heard why.
If you could also start with your name for our records, that'd be great.
I'm sorry, sir. No problem. That was next.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I had to jump the queue.
My name is Gary Pearson, and I live a few miles outside of Ontario. I'm a 50-year Oregon resident. I come here today as an Oregon citizen who is concerned about what can happen to our exclusive farm use land, even in the face of Oregon's land use laws that were designed to protect and preserve farmland over 30 years ago. While I use Malheur County as our point of light, the issues and ramifications of what is occurring there can occur anywhere in Oregon where agricultural crops grow primarily on irrigated soil. I brought a map to help demonstrate my discussion of how EFU law can potentially go wrong. I'll get to it in just a second. Malheur County is the second largest county in the state of Oregon and is the 12th largest county in the United States, the contiguous United States. But it only has a population of 33,000 people, and 95% of them live in a 50-mile-long, 6-mile-wide ribbon of land called the Lower Snake, Owyhee, and Malheur River Valleys. It is fueled almost entirely by agriculture. I have outlined the map in yellow to indicate that small ribbon of Oregon ground, which is surrounded by public ground managed by the Bureau of Land Management. That piece of land produces $261 million of Oregon income due to agricultural activity alone, and over $1 billion when you add sales, processing, packing, shipping, services, etc. That small ribbon of Oregon produces one quarter of all of the onions grown in the United States. It has acquired a national reputation for growing the finest jumbo and colossal sweet onions in the United States of America. But now that ribbon of land is under siege. Idaho Power has proposed to string a 500,000-volt transmission line with as many as 175 towers, 190 feet high, with sagging lines 35 feet off the ground directly through the heart of that ribbon of land. Even though public BLM land is available within eyesight of every single inch of that EFU outlined land. The proposed project flies in the face of the current Oregon EFU zone law that has been so faithfully honored and followed by the Malheur County farmers for over 30 years. The proposed project will be devastating to the local economy, taking out as much as 1,500 acres of EFU farmland via condemnation. That land is not replaceable, now or in the foreseeable future. Devaluation or condemnation of Malheur County EFU land is paramount to economic suicide. I just want to mention, I outlined this last night in yellow. Everything you see here in white I'll back off of that. 80% of what you see here in white in the 12th largest county in the United States, 80% belongs to all of us. It's public land. That's BLM land. And it backs up within eyesight of every single inch of this stuff in yellow here. Yet Idaho Power wants to bring their line down here, enter here, and right through the heart of that land. We think that's folly. For obvious reasons, and because of that, we urge the committee to look with favor on the amendment sponsored by Mr. Bentz, and that land simply cannot be taken out of production simply because it might represent the easiest and most convenient path for the utility involved. It just doesn't make any sense to us.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for joining us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on 3153. My name is James Jennings, and I work for Farmers Supply Cooperative in Ontario, Oregon, their aerial application division. We have a two-plane spray operation, and our customers, the majority of them, are in the Nyssa, Ontario, and Vail areas. And as my colleague here pointed out, this line is going to go right through the middle of everything that we spray. And basically, it's going to make any field within a mile of this power line very dangerous to spray. You got to remember, these towers are 195 feet tall. That's equivalent of a 20-story building. And they got, as I understand it, 18-inch in diameter wires that go between them. And if an airplane hits it, the plane's going to be a wreck and the pilot's going to be dead. So most of the time when we hit a power line, and we have hit a few, the airplane just goes right through them and no big deal. But this is a whole different category of thing. Because of the pollinator problem over there, we also have to night fly. And there's a reason these towers are 195 feet tall. If they're 200 feet, they got to light them. The FAA requires it. So we're going to have this 195-foot tall monster going, as I understand it, within 2 miles of the Ontario airport, and it's going to be invisible at night. How do we cope with that? The fields that we can spray, and we can field spray spray fields that are in the vicinity of the lines. We can go under the lines and we can parallel them, and there's ways around it, but it's going to take a lot longer time to do the fields, and time is money in our business. So we're going to have to raise our prices to our customers, and they're not going to like that. I was told to keep this short, so that's what I have. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. You've done that. You've done the keeping it short very well. Sir.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Korn. I come from Ontario, Oregon also. My family's farmed in Malheur County area for since 1935, since the land was taken out of the desert. We're row crop farmers producing onions, sugar beets, potatoes, corn, and wheat. And as maybe you're not aware, Malheur County is known as the onion capital of the world. And is that because of its rich soil, its hot, dry climate, and adequate irrigation water. It is an $85 million industry, and I brought a little bit of show and tell today. I brought some onions from the grocery store because they don't have any this big yet. But the point being, what Mr. Jennings is talking about is taking our crop, and those of you that have probably had an awesome blossom at Chili's or at Outback, chances are that onion came from Malheur County, because we're the only ones in this nation that can grow the large, consistent onions that they use for the awesome blossom. Matter of fact, that size of onion was developed for that very market. One of the pests that we deal with on a regular basis is an onion thrip, and it's this tiny insect about the size of the head of your pin that dwells down in the crown of the onion, and it crawls out and it chews and sucks on the, like a rasp on the onion leaves, scarring them up, drying them out. And also it carries a virus called iris yellow spot virus, and a virus that when it infects the onion, is a diamond-shaped lesion, and within a few weeks, it completely defoliates the plant. Thrip appear about mid-May to late May, and the only way we have to control them is through chemical control. People like Mr. Jennings, we depend on them heavily to be able to fly pesticides on a regular basis. In the hot summertime, onion thrip reproduce every 3 to 5 days, making the life cycle very short, meaning that we have to spray on a regular basis, usually on a weekly basis. As the crops get bigger, the summer gets hot, and we have to keep irrigation water going. This requires aerial spraying. Mr. Jennings has outlined some of the hazards of that. Now, you might think, well, this is only a 250-foot corridor, amounting to 1,200 or 1,300 acres. Maybe it's not that big of a deal. Well, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I want to testify to you that this is a big deal, because when you have an area zigzag through the county, as Idaho Power has proposed with this transmission line, you've created a vector or a safe haven for these insects to multiply and flourish unchecked. And when insects multiply and flourish, what happens? They spread out, putting our whole $85 million onion industry in jeopardy, not just a small corridor, not just a small area. Mr. Pearson showed you the map of the limited ground that we have. This is limited by the size, the boundaries of our irrigation districts. In eastern Oregon, we grow nothing without irrigation water, and we desperately need to be able to control these pests to maintain this industry. In these economic and challenging times that we live in, I think it's foolish to allow utilities, when they have viable alternatives to stay out of our EFU ground, to site these in public ground. And I know our time is short, but I would just encourage the committee to strongly consider the amendment that Representative Bentz has presented today, that we might be able to protect that resource that we as farmers and all Oregonians have strived so strongly to do for the last 30 years. Thank you, Chairman Reed and committee, for your time. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions for this panel, recognizing that we have several more panels? Representative Witt?
Yes, the panel members all talked about Idaho Power. I don't know if we're having anyone from that utility testifying today, but
their lobbyist is here.
But why is it that they aren't using BLM land?
That's an obvious question.
No applause, please. We're having a regular discussion here.
Do you want me to stop on that then, Chairman Reed?
You can respond if you like. We're just trying
to. Well, I don't want to. If I don't need to, that's fine.
Okay.
It's up to you, Chairman, whatever you want.
Go ahead. Go ahead if you'd like.
Is that okay?
Please.
We're trying to convince Idaho Power that the viable way is to go through the public ground. I think they felt that the easy way was to go through 400 private landowners of Malheur County, and they're finding, because the organization and dedication of our committee, Stop Idaho Power, that is not the case. And that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you very much, Chairman Reed.
Appreciate you being here. Next on our list, Clinton Kennington, Ken Taramura, and Patty Kennington.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Representative Chair Reed. We appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk to you today. My name is Clinton Kennington, and I reside in Malheur County. We have farm and have a dairy, and our family has been in Malheur County since 1950. If you went out in front of our house and or out by our house and stood halfway between our house and our dairy, which really isn't very far from Representative Bentz's house, you would be able to look down through there and see that there aren't any homes. Hence, Idaho Power came and said, well, let's put a power line down through there. Because in Idaho, they have covered their land with homes. They don't have any exclusive farm use land there. And it seemed odd to me because they've had lots of problems with dairies in the past in stray voltage, and it seemed like a really unwise thing to do. Not only is stray voltage injurious to animals, but these power lines are awful to work around. They limit you to 14-foot equipment. And that would mean going around some things, because these days farm equipment is large. This 1,500 acres taken out of production comes by figuring out how many acres are in a 250-foot wide corridor that is 50 miles long running through Malheur County. And that's where we come with over 1,500 acres that would be taken out. And that doesn't include access roads and inaccessible acres that are taken out of corners of your farm and that sort of thing. So there's going to be a lot of production lowered in Malheur County. We think that a 500 kV line would significantly interfere or completely stop irrigation. And if they decided they wanted to expand that corridor from just one line going through there to three or four or however many they want plus some gas lines, we would really, really be in trouble. A lot less income would come to the state because of the farming practices that are not going to be able to keep going, and to the federal. And with lower land values, with the result of this, there would be less money go to the counties. In light of the TMDL legislation that's been passed, wheel lines, center pivots, sprinklers, and all that's going to be required. Our farm has already got that, and boy, if they put that stuff down through the middle of our farm, boy, are we in trouble. The fact that that Idaho Power has been able to submit this proposal, even under existing Oregon statute, is what is a constant concern for us. If Idaho Power ultimately routes its transmission line through designated federal corridors, we still have the fear of them coming back on us in years to come. And we would like to have that fear go away. It seems to me that the passage of this amendment wouldn't cost the county or the state of Oregon not much, if anything. But not passing it, not making this amendment part of the land use law, would result in some loss of revenue to the counties and to the state. And so with that, I recommend the passage of Representative Bent's amendment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. Whomever would like to go next, please.
Yeah, Chairman Reed and members of the legislature. Am I coming in there?
Yeah.
I'm Ken Terramura. I'm onion grower in Ontario, Oregon. And I'm on the board of the Malheur County Onion Growers Association. I represent 200 onion growers and 12,000 acres of onions. We ship 35 to 40% of all the onions in the United States, August through April, which makes us the largest area. You can look us up on bigonions.com and see the rest of the information. We use 21st century technology, which is GPS. This system will not be effective under the lines and adjacent to the lines, adjacent to 500,000 volt lines. And the onion growers, Malheur County onion growers, ask you to route the line off their land, since there is only a finite amount of land in Oregon suited for onions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Chairman Reed and members of the committee, my name is Patty Kennington, and I live on Kennington Farms Dairy in Ontario. The entire length of our 320-acre farm was under Idaho Power's original proposed 500-kilovolt transmission line. It has taken a great deal of time and effort to have Idaho Power acknowledge our concerns. We believe that the amendment offered by Representative Vance would prove to be a narrowly defined application that would go a long way toward answering our problems. The amendment gives the county court the ability to determine the height of the transmission line where EFU land requires aerial application of pesticides. The language should not be a threat to Oregon cities or utilities unless they want to site high-voltage transmission lines across EFU ground that requires aerial spraying. ORS 215-275 Section 5 already gives the county court process jurisdiction over the mitigation of utility facilities on farmland. For example, the Malheur County Court Comprehensive Land Use Plan directs utilities to site across Category 8 land before Category 1 prime farmland. Malheur County officials and farmers in the Owyhee Irrigation District have determined the placement of 190-foot electrical towers across EFU ground would cause a significant change in accepted farm practices and a significant increase in the cost of farm practices on the surrounding farmland, including the need to redesign and rebuild an entire irrigation network, metal siphon deterioration by electrolysis, including the 4.5 mile Owyhee siphon, automation equipment and equipment that is very large becoming less useful underneath high voltage transmission lines. We ask for your assistance in giving our county courts an additional tool to protect valuable and irreplaceable farmland. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions for this panel? Appreciate you being here on a long trip, we know. Jay Chamberlain, Pat Phillips, Larry Price. Did I get any of those names right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just while they're setting up, I am visiting BigOnion.com, and I wanted the panel to know that there are a lot of great recipes, including onion saute with Zinfandel cream, which Representative Holvey might be making for us later. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Looking forward to that.
I've got one ingredient.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Reed and committee members. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Let me introduce myself. I'm Jay Chamberlain, project manager of the Owyhee project. I'm not going to a lot of detail about the project, but I've attached a pamphlet that kind of describes it is a federally built project. It was built just prior to the Depression, and it actually is your largest irrigation district in the state of Oregon, servicing about 120,000 irrigated acres. It takes in the communities of Adrian, Nessa, goes as far west as Vail, and also Ontario, and then to the north, almost to Weezer, Idaho. The North Canal is 70 miles long. That flow is 1,000 cubic feet per second. It is the lifeblood, as you have heard, of these growers. Without that, we would not have our Treasure Valley. And so it is extremely important that the location of this line is just extremely detrimental. And we are dominant row crop irrigation, which is in a furrow. We have some issues with the Clean Water Act, in which we are working with DEQ in preparations for the TMDL, or total daily maximum load issues. The growers have spent a great deal of capital cost, as spoken earlier also, with sprinkler irrigation. And this placement of this line is absolutely going to almost halt any of those proposed projects for the simple fact that wheel lines, pivots just cannot fit underneath this facility. There's been a great deal of capital cost out of the pockets of these growers, again, for these improvements, and they have gone to great lengths to try and meet these water quality standards, as well as groundwater issues that we are working with as well to be good stewards of the land. So with our concern is number one, water conservation on the farm is going to be very difficult. With the placement of this line, impact as far as water rights issues, as far as the district is concerned, again, those water rights are going to be jeopardized possibly by this placement. We are concerned because of, also spoken earlier, we, the district, which is these, the people behind me, they're my constituents, have invested a great deal in canal automation. Again, as we get into global change, we've noticed that our water supply is becoming less and less. We live in the desert. We don't have the precip that you folks have on this part of the state. Irrigation is our lifeblood, again, and it's the only way that we can produce and grow crops. We cannot allow something that will jeopardize that distribution system. We also are concerned about, because of the quality of water and, again, the distance that we have aquatic herbicide that we treat in the canal system. We're a closed system, which means that product, we have to, under DEQ's criteria, we have NPDES permit. We are concerned that possibly this could cause our canal automation to go into a failure mode or disrupt our signals, which could possibly contaminate our state waters and streams. That is a great concern to us as well. So with all this said, each year brings new challenges and difficulties for these growers, and we just feel, as been mentioned earlier, that placement of this line is move it out of these EFU lands and put it where it belongs, where we can continue to do as we have for 76 years, is to service these acres for agricultural use. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, again, thank you for letting us speak. My name is Pat Phillips. I don't know if you've received a copy of my written testimony yet, but this picture and that chart are part of my presentation. The pictures here will give you an idea of the siphon, which Mr. Chamberlain has just spoken of. The overall pictures were taken earlier this week, and the chart there is of the irrigated ground. Mr. Chamberlain supplied the map of the irrigated ground covered by the Owyhee project. The rest of the ground, the white, this is just a portion of Malheur County, a small portion of Malheur County, as you've been told before. Nancy, would you flip that? On the overlay that I'm going to throw at you, the two red lines represent the east and the west boundary of what was the proposed Boardman to Hemingway transmission line across our EFU ground. And in
may I have to just ask a quick question? You said was.
The line, Idaho Power at this point has taken all routes off the map. And we are now going to end into a process with Idaho Power to redecide that process. But that is going to be up to, I don't have the number in my head, but about 10 different counties to come together in groups of 40 per committee. There will be three committees. And we're speaking of, yes, Malheur County, Union, Baker, Harney, Grant, Umatilla, Morrill, plus Payette, Washington, Owyhee, and Canyon County, thank you, in the state of Idaho. There will be three committees, and Malheur and Grant and Harney County will be teamed with the Idaho counties to come up in addition to the other Oregon counties to come up with a proposed route. So we are going to have to present our arguments all over again to those Idaho counties, along with teaching the rest of the state of Oregon about EFU ground, which is not a commonly known thing. But anyway, this red line through there is the east and west boundary of what was the proposed B2H line, and I wanted to show you, in support of the rest of the folks who have been speaking here from Ontario, where that line actually traversed our irrigated ground.
Thank you. I'm sorry to take you off track. I just wanted to.
Yeah,
that was a different.
Do I get 30 seconds?
Absolutely. That's fine.
I'm here because we strongly believe that that electrical line, especially of the magnitude of B2H, will be a detriment if it is positioned on exclusive farm use land. The line in the adjoining access road, which I think is a big part of this, will be invasive to our complex irrigation system, difficult to work around, as has been mentioned before. We strongly believe it will create a dramatic economic effect to the agricultural production of our area if it is allowed to go through intensified farming areas such as Malheur County and other areas in the state. Personally, I believe the verb tense is wrong in that statement. I don't believe it will create a dramatic effect. I believe it is creating a dramatic effect. I make my living trying to sell real estate. As property brokers, we are already being told by potential buyers they don't want to buy certain properties, even though the properties are otherwise perfect, until the buyer knows whether or not the line is going to traverse the property. Presently, we have at least three farms for sale, which are all dependent on wheel lines for irrigation, and all lie within the originally proposed B2H line. The smallest of those properties is 70 acres, lying in a rectangle 1/4 mile wide and roughly a half a mile long. With towers every 1,320 feet, that means two towers on the property and an access road running the length of the property. This is devastating to the production. On the graphic, as I've said, it gives you an idea of where this line is going to was going to run. Please remember, there are 9,930 square miles in Mount Hare County, or 6,355,000 acres, with only some 256,000 acres irrigated. Mount Hare County is 94% rangeland. The overlay only shows a part of the county, as I said before. Therefore, I urge you, please, to proceed with adopting some restrictions and Representative Spence's amendment to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, my name is Larry Price. I farm and reside at 1681 Highway 201 in Adrian, Oregon. I farm with my brother, and I'm a third-generation operator on this farm with the fifth generation residing there. I raise alfalfa seed, grain seed, and also have a seed business that does business both in Oregon and Idaho, and my operation is only 1 mile from the Idaho border. Over the last 30 years, I've observed the growth in Idaho, with Boise now becoming the third largest city in the Pacific Northwest. With that growth, I've seen farm operations be gobbled up by housing development. And the way I describe it now is that it's basically a plague of houses within the farming community. And what we're seeing is operators selling out and moving and migrating to Malheur County to be able to operate farm operations, which is very unique, and a lot of the movement of ground in the last 3 to 4 years have been bought by Idaho farm operators, and their desire is to farm. This siting of the Boardman Hemingway 500 kV line has brought much fear and havoc and concern to the citizens of Malheur County. I've also submitted to you a copy of several letters that were sent by the sixth graders of the Adrian Grade School to the governor. The teacher met me 2 days ago and mentioned that he did this, and I said this committee might want to see some of these. Some of them are very unique, some of them are very thought-provoking. This site, this proposed site, was within 300 paces of our school. Those letters will tell those concerns. And here you got 11 and 12-year-old kids being concerned about issues. This proposed site cuts straight through my 650 acres that we operate. And if you look on that map, that little narrow piece there is our operation. And the red line has been drawn a little bit off to the side. Yeah. It really traverses clear through all of my operation. Some of the issues I have concerns with are, one, mentioned about the use of irrigation equipment as circles and wheel lines. Just in the last 5 years, the Waihi South Border Control has been granted OWEB grants, or the Oregon Enhancement Board, to convert 8 miles of canals in our area to underground pipeline. Over this period of time, our operation has developed over a 6-year period a plan to convert over the next 20 years our operation from a surface irrigated system to a sprinkler irrigation system. And it's going to take 20 years because it's very costly and becomes a hard time to amortize it. And so it'll take us at least 20 years to make that plan. If Idaho Power randomly puts those towers all through that little tiny strip, my plans will be nil and void, because those towers will interrupt everywhere those pivots circle. This also negates all the investment that Oregon has devoted to this OWEB grant. And some of this ground, the OWEB grant, almost tallies $8,000 an acre. So this investment that Oregon's made to clean up that water source along that Snake River, and the Snake River traverses right along the side of me, will potentially, if it's sited across my farm, be wasted investment for the state of Oregon. My second concern is that I'm an alfalfa seed grower, and the pilot earlier mentioned about pollinators. I do all my spray applications between sundown and midnight, and the reason is because the leaf cutter bees that we use to pollinate our alfalfa seed go into their domiciles or their little holes, and as soon as the sun goes down, and the same chemicals that will kill the lagus bug will kill a leaf cutter bee. So we have a very short window to spray, and it's all during the dark nights of the night, one, to protect those pollinators. My concern is that with these lines crossing across my operation, it will potentially interrupt my GPS services. And I know you may hear some arguments about that it does not interrupt it, but single signal satellite GPS signals will be interrupted intermittently by that. So what happens is, as you traverse through the field, the machine actually guides itself, doesn't veer off, and it automatically shuts the booms off. If I'm crossing across this operation, across this line, it'll potentially knock it out. And I've invested almost $15,000 in that just in the last year. The third issue, and I was talking about the leaf cutter bees, very unique. A bird and a bee have something very in common, and that is its north-south pole guidance system that allows it to find its home, or a bird finding its north-south directions. And what happens is, in a bee, in the pod of its stomach, in its abdomen, it has a pod that has a negative-positive charge that are lined up. In these transmission lines around that line, disturbs that, the magnetic field doesn't allow a bird to land on that line. It actually screws up its compass. And the bee is the same. Our concern is that as that pattern traverses off from that line, that because the bee is so much smaller than a bird, that it will interrupt its flight pattern and disturb it. So when it comes out of its home and flies across my field, and they work in a outward pattern, as they would cross this line, they potentially would be totally mixed up and could not relocate themselves, and their compass would be all haywire. In that, they would drop into the canopy of the alfalfa seed, and as I would apply my applications, I would kill them, or they would actually get disturbed and move off. Leaf cutter bee is very much distinctly different than a honeybee. It's a very small bee, and it's a solitary bee. And my grandfather, when I was 3 years old, was one of the first guys to propagate it, and we have much experience in how those bees are, how they move back and forth, and how you can disturb their flight pattern. So looking at Representative Benson's bill, or his amendment, I would recommend that you adopt that amendment, but I'd also recommend a few changes. One of my, I used to serve on OFS, Oregonians for Food and Shelter Board, and my recommendation to that amendment is, if you look on line 20, it says, talks about insecticides and pesticides. I would suggest that you strike insecticides and add fertilizer in that point. A little clarification, a pesticide is a general topic or general category of insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, and rodenticides. So an insecticide, say an insecticide, that is a one item note. So that should be struck, but fertilizer should be added, and that comes from the recommendation for Oregon's Food and Shelter and my observations of this bill. This is an excellent, excellent amendment, and I ask you to adopt it.
Thank you very much for your comprehensive testimony. Are there questions for this panel? And I neglected to welcome Representative Freeman, who's joined us. Thanks for being here. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on our list, Nancy Perrin,
Diane Bloomer, Kate Kimball, please. Recognizing the time and the number of people yet to testify and the fact that we have another, at least one more bill we'd like to take on, I ask if you can keep your comments brief, please. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So thank you, Chair Reed, and all the committee members. My name is Nancy Perrin from Baker City, and this is the first time I've ever done this. So, but it was worth getting up at 2 this morning and getting on the bus and coming over here because I'm very passionate about doing something about this 500 kV power line that is proposed to come through our place. In Baker County, we have 70 miles of this proposed route, and 63 of those are through exclusive farmland. So that's the most on any part of this route. And so I'm actually part of a group, Move Idaho Power, and we're working to find an appropriate location for this route where the scenic view shed, private landowners, the agriculture, and our most important cultural heritage icon, the Oregon Trail, will not be impacted. And it's clear from what we've heard already that power lines and exclusive farm use are not compatible. I learned that through this process already, and you've heard a lot about that. I just want to say that 63 miles of EFU land is 1,909 acres that will be taken out of production in our county. And ground is one of the most important resources we have in Baker County, and we don't have 1,900 acres to throw away. So turning this valuable farmland into a crop of towers and roads makes for a lousy return on investment to private property owners and our county economy. And we also have, one of the things we have in Baker County also, across this exclusive farm use land, we have the Oregon Trail. And my family homesteaded in 1917 right below the Interpretive Center. In fact, we had to give some land so they could have the Interpretive Center. And we've been very respectful of that land where the Oregon Trail goes. And it's horrifying to me to realize that these towers can suddenly just appear when we have for generations respected that, and we've also respected the use of the land. So just considering this corridor, siting it on private agricultural land is development at its worst, in direct conflict with the concept of highest and best use that we respect so much, especially when there are reasonable alternatives and thousands of acres of public land available. In Baker County, we have 52% public land, and we have possibilities of putting the route there, and that's what we're proposing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. I especially want to acknowledge and thank you for recognizing this is the Sustainability and Economic Development Committee and using double-sided on your written testimony. Thank you very much.
Yes, and I want to say, if you came into Eastern Oregon, you'd see this sign. We have it everywhere. And stop Idaho Power from putting it across exclusive farm use land and across our easements and taking our acres.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chairman Reed.
And if you could just move the microphone a bit away from your mouth, it won't distort quite so much.
Okay. Thank you. Chairman Reed, Representative Cliff Benz, and members of the Sustainability and Economic Development Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak at this hearing. For the record, my name is Diane Bloomer. I live in Durkee, Oregon, in Baker County. I come from a fifth generation of farm agriculture family. Six of my great-great-grandparents came as pioneers across the Oregon Trail and settled in Baker County. My husband and I own and operate a cattle hay business in Durkee, Oregon. Idaho Power has has proposed to build a 500 kV transmission line through Baker County. Our property is within that proposed route. We are concerned with the adverse impact on our exclusive farm use land. The placement of these massive structures and foundations would impact the ability to put in place improved irrigation practices such as pivots, wheel lines, and buried improved flood irrigation. There would be a potential loss of water rights due to the lack of ability to irrigate in the most efficient way. There are many landowners enrolled in conservation practices in our county, such as CRPs and CREPs. Incorporating treatments such as aerial spraying, planting, and spot burning treatments would be limited with these high towers and lines. The potential of invasive weed invasions would be an economic detriment with the construction of the towers and service roads to maintain this project. Each county and community has their own very unique and important situations that should be considered individually with caution. We want to protect our EFU ground in Baker County, and we do have the fear of the declaration of eminent domain. Thank you for your consideration and time today.
Thank you, Ms. Brewer.
Ms. Kimball.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kate Kimball, and I'm here today on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, which is a statewide land use advocacy organization. For that reason, my comments are going to be more abstract and statewide than focused on particular situations that you've heard about today. Our primary concern is that when it comes to utility siting, the utilities have the upper hand in siting on farmland. We think farmland should be an area of last resort, not first resort, when it comes to utility siting. We wouldn't cite utility pipeline or transmission towers an Intel or Nike site. We'd think that was pretty silly because those are industrial sites where people work and earn a living. But farmland and ranchland is the same situation. If you put an industrial, if you put a transmission line or a pipeline on that land, it may not have buildings on it, but that land is where people earn their living, and it should be protected that way so that utilities are the last that's the last place you want to site these utilities. One of the other concerns we have is that often when utilities are sited, and any mitigation or concerns are based on the footprint of that utility, not the area of impact. In, say, the Willamette Valley with tiles for water drainage, if you trench up a field and then you've disturbed all those tiles, you've completely changed the water drainage system. In eastern Oregon and western Oregon, we irrigate, so if you have pivot lines or any kind of irrigation pipes, if you start trenching all of that, then people have to adjust, as you've already heard today. And we're very concerned that it's the total impact to these businesses. I just want to underscore, these are businesses we're talking about, not people who maybe are just concerned about the utilities, but it's the impact of the businesses that should be taken into account because this is how they earn their living. So we need to, I think, correct the law so that we're really taking into account what is the total loss in production. Is somebody losing an entire year because the utility chose to come in the spring when you'd be planting and use that time to install a pipeline or transmission tower? One of a couple of practical things, for pipelines, there are road right-of-ways. We should be using them. One of the arguments we hear is that it's not safe to put a pipeline in a road right-of-way, to which I say, well, if it's not safe to put it there, why is it safe to put it in a farmer's field? I mean, that would seem to me an equal safety problem. Another concern is that with segmentation, that we need to be looking at any kind of utility installation in terms of its impact, looking segment by segment. Does this segment have to be here? Could this not be on farmland? Could it be at the edge of a field, maybe instead of in the middle? And so we need a better way of looking at that. This bill, 3153, takes some good steps in that direction. The amendments, we certainly understand the impetus behind them and support the concept of them, but we would not want to do a complete replacement of 3153, and we'd like to see some other technical changes, which we'd be happy to discuss later. But thank you for your time, and please protect farmland. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bloomer, you mentioned pivots and wheel lines. Can you tell me how approximately what percentage of the farm acreage an exclusive farm use would have to be irrigated in your area?
In Durkee?
Mm-hmm.
In Durkee, we're underneath the Unity Irrigation. It's called the Burnt River Irrigation District. And right now, we have the opportunity through some government agencies to enroll in conservation practices, which will include improved irrigation practices. And with that, it's kind of in motion now, and I know people have applied for those.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if that 500-kilovolt transmission line goes through and you or any one of the other farmers had to go out and move or maintain these pivots and wheel lines, isn't that something akin to taking your toaster into the bathtub with you?
That could be a strong possibility. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for making the long trip. Next on the list, Tom Gallagher, Bob Hall, Gary Bauer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing PGE. I'm looking at the bill and at the amendments as I address the panel. We understand that people don't want windmills and pipelines and high voltage lines on their farms or in their areas. It's inhibiting their work and obstructing their lives.
Scally, would you move the microphone just a little bit closer to your soft-spoken gentleman?
Yes, thank you very much.
Help, help some folks in the audience, it seems. Thank
right.
you.
The problem the utilities have is how do we meet our other obligations? The bulk of the people in Oregon live inside an urban growth boundary. We have an obligation to serve. We have a growing load. We have renewable mandates in the state that you passed last session. They're going to require us to increase the number of renewable energy units that we have in the state. That's 25% of our load by 2020. Those are hundreds of windmills. Those windmills have to be sited where the wind is blowing, and where the wind is blowing in the airsheds are not usually next to existing transmission corridors and transmission lines. So you have to develop, you have to install transmission lines to get that power onto the grid. If we didn't have to do the renewable energy at this level, we wouldn't be out in rural areas as often as we are. We also after this session, we're going to have a obligation to reduce our fossil fuel load. Our fossil fuel load will require us to build basically right now under the technology existing a number of windmills. The number of windmills that PGE would have to build to meet its obligations under our statute is in the hundreds. Each one of these windmills takes a half an acre and requires transmission lines to be sited with it. There's no way that we can get these windmills built and move this power without crossing EFU at some point. I'm sorry. There are ways in which we can mitigate for this. And I'd like to talk for a second about some of the ways that are in the bill. When you build a transmission line, 230, 540, it's a couple hundred square feet of concrete put in the ground. It can't go in a right-of-way. It's just too big. You can't put a windmill in the right-of-way. Those kind of arguments may apply a little better to gas pipelines, but they certainly don't apply to transmission towers and to windmills. If you try to go next to, and you have more room with an electrical transmission line to move it around, zigzag it around, so siting is a very is a very challenging and a very worthwhile process that every utility goes through. Spend hundreds of hours in community meetings trying to figure out where to site the pipelines. Now, I have no comment on Idaho Power's process, but I've been working in siting now in this legislation for the last 20 years, and I also do work with different companies as they go out and try to do their public outreach to do this. There are always going to be places where you have difficulty, where you have people that don't want to give up a right. And so somewhere along the line of siting that transmission line or putting in the wind farm, all of Bigelow Canyon, for example, is on leased land. So there are people out there that are willing to do that. It's the transmission lines themselves that increase that problem. What I'm going to end up saying here is we have conflicting public policies in the state. Not that the policies conflict, but that those policies create conflict. And it is a problem that has to be solved. It's a problem that affects ratepayers. It's a problem that affects individuals where the siting takes place. And it's a problem that affects the utilities that have to do it. You can't leave the mandate in place to produce the renewable energy and to site the transmission, and you can't leave the utility left out there by itself without statutory help, without local community help, without other ways to meet those obligations. So I'll just stop at that. And Bob will talk just for a second about the problem with the amendment on the 50-foot towers.
Thank you, Tom. Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Bob Hall. I'm here today representing PGE. I've got a little bit different side of it than Tom does. I've retired out of PGE and done some of the technical work for the company over the years. I hadn't seen this proposed amendment until just after the hearing started, frankly. And I noticed that 50-foot height on the on the towers. I made some very quick call to some of our engineers, and what I'm giving you is kind of a back of the envelope, so don't quote me on these exact figures. But if you've got, say, for instance, a 230 kV line, that you can't have that line at the sag more than 35 feet, or less than 35 feet above the ground. That sounds like a lot. But by the time you figure the distance between the towers, picture driving up and down I-5 between here in Portland, that line off to the side, you notice a pretty good sag in that line. It's well above 35 feet. In midsummer, when the ambient temperature is high and the power loads are high because of air conditioning, that line is going to be down significantly lower than it is now. So the ability to site a transmission line with that 50-foot requirement in there would be probably tantamount to a prohibition to get a major transmission line through there. Just the height of the towers are going to have to be probably in excess of 100 feet, possibly up to 150 feet with a 500 kV line. So I understand what the folks are trying to do, but like Tom said, we've got a problem with getting the power, you know, to the people that use it. And we have a mandate to go to green power, and just kind of in the middle of an issue here. So if you have any questions, I'll be glad to attempt to answer them.
Maybe we should start by turning the lights off here so we can reduce our own power a little bit.
I wasn't going to suggest that, sir.
Mr. Chair, that's demand reduction. You're not going to get a renewable energy credit for that.
I understand. Just reduce the load a little bit, perhaps. Mr. Bauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer, Northwest Natural. I won't repeat what Mr. Gallagher said in terms of the whole issues of trying to site facilities, but just a quick comment about the bill as written. It applies to both site-specific facilities, as he mentioned. It's not just windmills or things like that, but and also linear facilities. But give you an example, that Northwest Natural has an underground storage field near Mist, Oregon, which is actually in a forest zone. And that is a site where we had originally taken natural gas out of the ground. We now inject gas back into the ground and store it there for winter peaking purposes. Without that facility, we would not be able to meet our customers' demands during the winter. Because it's located where it is, then it requires us to be able to build pipelines from that facility back out into our network. That has resulted in pipelines being sited both in forest lands and in EFU zone lands. And it is incumbent upon the entity that's trying to build those to try to work as well as they can with all of the property owners. And there are processes for determining how you site these facilities. It's a multi-year process. It's not something that you just automatically go out and do. You have to take into account all of the environmental issues you have to take into account. If you're going to cross or bore under a river, there's only certain locations that you're allowed to do that on, which then will drive the location of how you get your pipe to that spot. All of those are taken into account in a process that is supposed to allow both the property owners, public agencies, and the entity proposing a project to try to work out issues and agreements. And there are a lot of case law on how you compensate property owners, but you compensate them not only on the value of the land, but you compensate them for any crops that they cannot grow during the process or any crop damage. You compensate for and rebuild any fences. You rebuild any drainage tile. If they are hampered in terms of just being able to use the rest of the property during that process, you have to compensate them for that. So there's a fairly well-established process for compensation. And with that, I'll stop and take any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Benz?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. You gentlemen bring years of experience to this process, so I'm going to take advantage of that by asking you to tell us how you would suggest we change the Oregon's law to promote greater use of public land. Because we're all familiar with the devices that are available for EFU land, how one condemns it, and what people are paid. The issue and the goal here is to try to move this transmission to public land where there are fewer people. What would you recommend, and I'll take the answer from any one of you, that we do to make that happen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gary Bauer. For our projects, we generally start by looking at public lands. But again, there you have to look at the purposes of that public land, how it's being used, and you also have to work with those agencies. But in our projects, we generally start looking at those. You cannot get the entire length of a route usually on public land. The problem with being in a road right-of-way is frequently the right-of-way is not wide enough to accommodate the project. In addition, that's generally the right-of-way also tends to have other utility facilities, and I'll say, for example, our local distribution system, the pipes that generally are taking the gas to your home are in public rights of ways. They're smaller pipes, and we're able to do those and still accommodate telecommunications and electricity and water and sewer. When you get into a larger transmission line, you don't have the space generally in a right-of-way to accommodate that.
Sounds like you have an answer here. Do you want
to follow up? Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, let me add a couple of things to that from the electrical side, because we're not just talking about transmission lines here. We're also talking about...
Speak up.
I'm sorry. We're also talking about, generating sites, windmill sites and other sites. So there are places where they have to be located. There are sites that work and sites that don't work. So to get from that site to the transmission line where you're going doesn't always allow you to go across public land. Public land is much more prevalent in the eastern side of the state than it is on the western side. We still have to get over the mountains where the majority of people live. So once you get on this side, the public land piece doesn't work very well. You are going to be the bulk of the time in public right-of-way or private land.
Follow up?
Right. My question was, what would you change in Oregon law that would make it easier to go across? And when I say public land, you are correct. I am focusing on the eastern part of the state where there's a great deal of federal land. So I should rephrase my question and just say, is there something we should do with our state policy that would prompt greater placement of these new transmission systems on federal land?
I suppose, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I suppose you could in the statute say that each siting unit must look first at utilizing public land. You could have a hierarchical process. I think right now in practice you will find that people do that, that will not solve your problem. It will put more in statute, but it will not exactly result where you want to be. And I don't think that people would object to some sort of a hierarchical process, because as you go through the public process, that's exactly what people ask you to do.
One last please. Follow-up. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair. The there is a reason that they look first at the federal land and then don't go there. There's a reason, and I'm really asking you folks to spell that reason out and suggest to us what we might do about it.
Mr. Chair, I have no idea on siting on federal land. That's beyond me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I know in a project that we are looking at right now, we are actually looking at a lot of federal land. There's a lot of negotiations with those federal agencies. In fact, we can't really get from one side of the state to the other without going through a lot of federal land. It's a process of just working through all of the issues, I think, with the federal agencies.
Maybe we need a memorial, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some observations here. The folks from these utilities, I think, are an example of trying to accommodate the needs of everyone and finding the routes that can best serve everyone's needs. I think that contrasts markedly with the chart over there that has every appearance to me that folks have gone out of their way to run that line right through the very best farmland that exists in Malheur County. And that's inappropriate. And we had testimony earlier that said that folks in Idaho have torn up farmland with housing developments. I don't think they need to be here in Oregon tearing up the best farmland that we have in the state. And given the Forest Service inability to manage its forests, maybe we'd do a little land improvement by running more utilities through federal land.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Representative Holby, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess specifically about this line that's on the chart, and I guess I'm hearing that you're saying that this particular line is bringing power from wind farms, and I guess looking in the chart, it's bringing it into the Columbia Basin.
You may be giving us a nice segue here. I don't know if you gentlemen probably don't want to answer that necessarily. Mr. Brenneman is here.
Mr. Chair, I mean, they were speaking of that, that this was about bringing the electricity from wind farms into the population center. So I'm assuming that we're coming from wind farms in Idaho?
I misunderstood. I thought you were asking about that one specifically, and certainly I'd give them a chance to answer if they want to.
I was talking about this one specifically because I thought that's what they were addressing, that this line was bringing power from wind farms into the population that needs it, which I'm assuming is
somewhere down the Columbia. Far be it for me to try to put words in anyone's mouth. Would you, gentlemen, care to answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, I represent PGE. This is an Idaho Power line. I don't have any idea what their purposes in this line are. What I'm talking about are the uses that we are going to begin siting at and looking at right now as we have to develop out our renewable energy for customers in Salem and Portland area.
Okay, so you weren't speaking to this line specifically.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Given that and given the lateness of the hour, I know you have a specific question. Mr. Brenneman, would you like to make any comments? The bulk of the discussion has been about Idaho Power, and I want to give you a chance to say something before we close out today.
Just what I was about to say. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Brenneman. I represent Idaho Power Company. I'm not entirely comfortable today sitting here with my back to a room full of
anger. We'll take care of you. We'll take care of you. You're all fine.
Okay. Until yesterday, I thought this bill really was dealing with the gas lines that were running through farm territory. In the last day or so, well, it wasn't until about 11 o'clock they have finally viewed the Dash 1 amendments. When I got to the Capitol in January, I began to hear a lot with my friends in the natural resource-based area that Idaho Power had some problems in their service area of Malheur and Baker County as regards this Boardman to Hemingway project. My friends in the community, when they had groups of their membership visiting, allowed me an opportunity to go down and meet with rural co-ops, as an example, some members of the Farm Bureau, and listen to what they had to say about the project. It was universally unacceptable on my terms for what I was hearing from the people that, like you've heard from today. And Idaho Power listened. They listened to me when I said I'd back up and start this thing all over. They've listened to the people in Malheur and Baker County who have asked for the same opportunity to come and talk. And last week, I thought everybody knew that we shelved this project as it exists and was presented here today, but we have. One of the big problems in the project was a substation that engineers put in western Idaho at a spot called Sand Hollow, and it was not popular in Idaho. So the engineers have pulled that project. It means that the project now does not have to go through Ontario. As late as this morning, I was talking with personnel in Boise that are working on this project, and they've asked me to submit all the names I can of people that should be represented on these committees that are being put together so that a new pathway for the project can be found over there in a more acceptable situation. If someone hears of somebody that should be involved, give their name to me. Like I said, I'm still passing those names along. In all the years I've served Idaho Power over here since 92, I'm usually trying to spend my time during the session to figure a way to get Idaho Power out of a bill. I haven't been the subject or target of a bill in the time that I've represented them, and it's not a comfortable situation. I'll only tell you, it's been a company I've been proud to work for in these years, and one that has been responsible, part of the community, responsive to the ratepayers, their customers. They try to serve them the best way they can, and they're going back to reopen the process. I don't have all the answers about why 15% of this is BLM land. I do know. I've been told that there's an endangered critter in there, a sage grouse, that you have to stay away from. And there are some of those problems. If you want more information on this project, I can arrange a team to come over from Boise that will come in at a regular basis and keep you informed of what's going on. It is a big project. It's going to serve the whole Northwest. It serves, projected to serve about a half of our needs, so it's meant to help Bonneville, the other privates, everybody in the whole Northwest, the citizens that need the electricity coming back and forth. We're an importer sometimes, and sometimes we're an exporter.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm just curious. I know you serve some parts of Oregon. How much of Oregon does Idaho Power serve?
We have 17,000 customers around Ontario Vale, Jordan Valley. I'm not exactly sure right on the border, but when I look for a way to get out of a bill, I say if you're an out-of-state company that serves fewer than 25,000 customers in the state of Oregon, this doesn't apply.
Any other questions? Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I think that kind of explanation could be useful, but I think the folks that need it the most would be the folks here in the audience whose land is up for consideration here, and I really think that would go a long ways in patching up some real difficulties that folks are obviously having here. They just don't know, and I think that kind of community town hall might be helpful.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt. I just think it took a while for the wheels to stop turning and start reversing, and the process is going to take a slow and careful step all the way to make sure everybody gets their say.
See the chair of the Land Use Committee lurking out there, so unless there are any other questions, we'll
conclude.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you. I think the concluding comment I would have is just to reiterate what Representative Witt suggested. Town halls are a good thing. Many of us do them. And I'm reminded, as a native Idahoan, of the comment that Governor Andrus had when he was governor of Idaho. He said the only reason so many people live east of the Mississippi is because they don't know any better. We have a lot of people who want to come here, so this may be the beginning of the sort of conversation we have as more people are here and we all like to have lights and electricity.
I understand you're from Idaho, and in fact, my boss Jeff Malman thinks that you might be a classmate of his younger brother, Rick.
I remember him. That's right. Before we close out the public hearing, I want to note for the record, since we're out of time, we did receive written testimony from Susan Hansen, Larry Dyke, I hope I've said that correctly, Matt and Alice Urey, League of Oregon Cities, represented by Daniel Eisenbeis, and Randy Leonard, City Commissioner in Portland. So commend those to your attention as well. And that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3153. Before we adjourn, let me just remind the committee we're going to reconvene for a separate meeting tonight at 5:30 in Hearing Room D, not here, but Hearing Room D, and we'll look forward to seeing you then. Adjourn. Thank you. Oh, and before I didn't drop the gavel yet. Thank you. We're going to carry over House Bill 2598, the work session on that, and House Bill 2626, the work session on that. Thank you very much for adjourning.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, it's like not the gavel.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Just.